This free programming is paid for by the listener sponsors of KPFK. During our fund drive, you can pledge online by clicking the links on the front of kpfk.org. Thank you for supporting Free Speech Radio.
This is KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live worldwide on kpfk.org. Make a contribution to KPFK today. The call just takes 2 minutes of your time for the hundreds of hours you listen over the course of the year. Call 818-985-5735 and volunteer during the fund drive. We are at 3729 Cahuenga Boulevard West, and simply come into the station or call 818-985-2711, extension 513. Stay tuned for Background Briefing with Ian Masters coming up next.
The Red Riding Trilogy is an ambitious, dark, thrilling series of crime drama films set in Yorkshire in the 70s and 80s, adapted from David Peace's cult noir novels, running at the New Art in West Los Angeles for 1 week beginning February 12th. Film club members are invited to call the KPFK front desk at 818-985-2711 for a pair of tickets to one of the three films.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin in a moment and discuss a couple of subjects in the news. We'll start out looking into the Tea Party convention just held in Nashville and the racist speech by Republican presidential candidate Tom Tancredo, and move to the embarrassing ramblings of Sarah Palin, who was the Republican candidate for vice president and is now flirting with being their presidential nominee in 2012. Joining us will be Max Blumenthal, an award-winning journalist whose book, Republican Gomorrah, looked into the racist tendencies of the right wing of the Republican Party. And joining Max is Stephen Piggott, a research fellow with the Center for New Community, who has just been mingling with the Tea Partiers in Nashville, Tennessee. And then joining us to discuss the American right and the extent to which the Republican Party has been taken over by activists on the right who are now organizing to help their candidates in primaries and to harm the so-called RINOs, Republicans in name only, will be Jonathan Weiler, a professor of international studies at the University of North Carolina, whose latest books, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, takes on the issues of the authoritarian streams in contemporary American politics, a book we're offering up here today in our winter fund drive for those who support Background Briefing and the Daily Briefing here at 818-985-5735, a number that you will become increasingly familiar with over the next 2 hours. The book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, we're offering up for $125 donation to this program, Background Briefing, here on, what is this, the fourth or fifth day, I think, of the fund drive. And then in the second hour, we'll be looking into the shadow elite and the privatization of national security with Dr. Janine Waddell, who's a professor at the School of Public Policy at George Mason University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. Her new book, which has been the Huffington Post Book of the Month, is Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. And she'll be setting up this further discussion we'll be having, where we look into the growing private-public takeover of our government. We'll look into the relationship of the intelligence services and corporate America in terms of economic espionage. We hear a lot about China's economic espionage, but very little about America's. So we're joined by Eamon Javis, who's a reporter who covers the intersection between Washington and Wall Street. His new book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, is just out, and we're offering it up here for a $125 donation to this program, Background Briefing, here on this Sunday at 818-985-5735. Let's now turn to the subject of the Tea Party gathering that took place there in Nashville over the weekend. The keynote speech was given last evening by Sarah Palin with a very orchestrated and controlled Q&A session that followed I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and the New York Times bestselling author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Blumenthal's work has been featured on a number of prominent outlets. He's also been honored by the USC Annenberg Online Journalism Award for investigative reporting and is the Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute and a research fellow at Media Matters for America, and up until recently was a senior contributor to The Daily Beast. Joining him is Stephen Piggott, who's a research fellow with the Center for New Community, a national organization committed to building community, justice, and equality. Stephen has just been in Tennessee getting first-hand experience of the so-called first Tea Party convention. And beginning with you, Stephen, I saw the Tancredo speech or clips of it. He was the opening speaker, and of course the keynote speaker last evening was Sarah Palin. But beginning with the Tancredo speech, it was overtly racist in as much as he said that people who don't know how to spell vote and who cannot say it in English have elected a committed socialist ideologue to the presidency. What was extraordinary about that, Stephen, was I saw the clip played later on ABC's Evening News with Diane Sawyer, and they cut out the piece where Tancredo mentioned those people who couldn't say the word vote in English, clearly referring to the bugaboo that obsesses Tancredo and the platform upon which he ran for president of the United States, the so-called immigrant question. So do you have any idea why that happened? I know, you know, this may not be your specialty, but I'm absolutely confused as to why the mainstream media appears to be playing down and censoring what these people are saying down there in Nashville, and which indicates who they really are.
I think that Mr. Tancredo's speech was obviously overtly racist, and that I think it's ludicrous that the national media censored him. He's been promoting an anti-immigrant agenda since he entered the political scene 10 years ago, and I think the fact that the media shut that the most racist part of his speech down was outrageous.
And you, since you were there and you met with and mingled with the Tea Partiers, did you get a whiff of at least, if it wasn't the racism, at least the feeling that they supported Tancredo's agenda?
Yes. If during his whole speech, he got at least three or four large ovations. Everyone got to their feet and clapped what he was saying. And I think it actually got the event off to a good start for the anti-immigrant people who were there. And I think a lot of people who were there that I talked to, they agreed with Tancredo, and they were very happy with what he said.
And Max Blumenthal, the author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, I'm beginning to see from what I saw on television of this Teabag convention, and obviously they don't represent the entire movement, and some parts of the movement weren't happy about the for-profit nature, that it cost $550 to get in, and that Sarah Palin was getting $100,000, which she then was going to donate back to the cause, which raises the question of why did she bother to take the check in the first place. However, it seems to me that this is a movement not about shattering the party, the Republican Party. This is a movement about taking it over. Even though they say that some of them aren't Republicans, that a lot of them are independents, the Palin presence and the way that she is obviously there to corral the right wing of this party, which was, after all, the reason why she was put on the ticket with McCain to bring the right wing voters in. This all seems to me to be fairly straightforward. The right of the Republican Party is going to take over. They're going to be very active in the primaries to get rid of candidates that they don't like, the so-called rhinos, Republicans in name only, and elect these extremely conservative Republicans. So, What I mean, do you disagree? I mean, shut me up.
I think you're completely right, Ian. That's what That's what this is about. But in my book, I'm able to document. I kind of have an echo, by the way, which is sort of
well, that's okay.
But in my book, I'm able to document how this movement already took over the party, and what the Tea Party movement is basically doing now is mopping up. They're cleaning up the mess. But what they've done, I just want to kind of I want to look at whether this movement has actually been influential, because they've claimed credit for three major victories that the Republican Party has had in New Jersey, the defeat of Governor John Corzine, with Chris Christie, who's pretty conservative, but it has some moderate tendencies. In Virginia, Bob McDonnell, a Christian right candidate, who is the first Republican to be elected governor there since the 90s, who ran to the center and won on the strength of suburban independents, including in Democratic areas, by hiding his right-wing tendencies, and now in Massachusetts with Scott Brown, who's a rhino, who's for abortion, who's for gay marriage, who just won Ted Kennedy's seat. And the Tea Party crowd wants to take credit for these, but the only election that I've seen the Tea Party crowd have any influence in is in the special congressional election in New York's 23rd district last year, when they actually ran a teabagger, this unknown teabagger lawyer named Doug Hoffman, against a moderate Republican woman, Didi Scozzafava. They knocked the Republican woman out of the race, and then the Democrat won for the first time in this conservative district in upstate New York in 100 years. And that's the dynamic I think we're going to be seeing when the Tea Party crowd can move in and really make an impact. So they're running against Charlie Crist in Florida, who's pretty conservative and who's guaranteed victory, in my opinion, with a really extreme right-wing candidate, Marco Rubio, who isn't. They're making some moves in California, and Sarah Palin at the Tea Party convention sort of hailed the idea of these primaries, Republican primaries, where they knock out very strong Republican candidates and run extreme right-wing candidates in a general election. I think the Tea Party crowd will continue the shattering of the Republican Party at a time when the Republicans look ready to pick up lots of seats in 2010 and capitalize on a discontent with Obama from independents and the demoralization of the left because Obama has failed to fulfill his messianic promises during the campaign to change the world.
And Stephen Pigott, having been there in Nashville, do you think that this movement that prides itself on it being independent, and Sarah Palin mentioned that, you know, even though she was a Republican candidate for vice president, her husband's an independent, and that she welcomes the independents. But my overall impression was that this is a fraud. This is really about the Republican Party, you know, using its kind of attack dogs on the right, but then sort of, you know, drawing the chain in and making sure it doesn't get out of control. And Max just said that Rubio was running against Chris down there. My understanding is that Rubio is actually doing well in the poll. So we'll talk about that in a second. But I'm detecting something of a fraud here, that this is really a subsidiary of the Republican Party that's being given a little rope to get some headlines, but at the end of the day, they'll obediently come back into the fold.
I wouldn't, to be honest, call the Tea Party. I would call it a vehicle, not a movement. And I think it's a vehicle to create a political space for racism.
Mm-hmm. And just elaborate further, if you will.
You see, you have these far-right candidates that are not going to, they're not going to be elect. They don't want to be part of the Republican Party. But the whole, when I was down there, everyone was talking about what do we do next? What do we do next? And the main outcome was that we need to elect people who agree with our values, and it's faith-based voting. That's religious right over again.
Well, one of the things that I found extraordinary about it, and I know and maybe Max can comment on this, the speech by Sarah Palin was so scary, and that was the impression I got when she first came onto the national stage was, my God, this woman doesn't know what she's talking about. And it was even more apparent that she was reading a script and talking about things, particularly when she talked about national security, that she really hadn't a clue about. And it's deeply disturbing. And what was really disturbing was that all of the pundits, including this fellow from the Daily Beast, who wrote a book called Wing Nuts, which was all about how crazy this movement is, he was dutifully saying on CNN how good her speech was. And it's as though the word has come down from the press barons: you've got to be nice to these people, and we've got to treat this idiotic woman as though she's actually making sense. Max, do you have an explanation for that?
Well, that's just a human explanation. The bar's been set pretty low for Sarah Palin. It's as if Maggie Simpson finally uttered a word, and everyone's cheering. I don't think Sarah Palin can do anything but damage to the party as long as she's out there. And I think the people who are the most terrified by Palin's speech were Republican consultants inside the Beltway. As I said before on your show, Ian, Sarah Palin has two constituencies: the far right and lovers of unintentional comedy. And you and I fit into that second constituency. So we're going to keep getting more of that. But going back to what Stephen said, I think the Tea Party movement has created a safe space for a lot of people to express their racial resentment and to push for extreme legislation. And the movement, on the one hand, as you pointed out, is being turned into a get-out-the-vote operation for the Republican Party in 2010. And there is a fraud-like element to it, or an insincere character to it. On the other hand, I just got back from Montgomery, Alabama, and I went to a Tea Party rally at the State House there. This is, you know, where they really hold power, in the Deep South. And I watched these Tea Partiers who were holding signs including that said, "We came unarmed this time, and all of our enemies have Muslim names," march into the State House and come out with a bunch of friendly legislators declaring victory. They just passed a state sovereignty resolution declaring states' rights and their intention to resist the federal government. This is the same language we heard under George Wallace when LBJ tried to pass the Civil Rights Act, and there were Confederate flags waving. The crowd was about as white as Tiger Woods' stable of mistresses, meaning there were no black people there. And so I do think that there is a strong element of racial resentment in this movement. And what that does is it lends the movement a southern character and makes it very difficult for it to appeal to independents in other parts of the country. Americans just don't like rabble. They don't like open displays of racism. And that's why this movement, I think, is going to remain marginalized, but it's still going to cause a lot of damage within the Republican Party.
And Stephen Pigott, having witnessed this Tea Party convention, which doesn't represent all of the party, but at least it's getting a lot of headlines. What's your feeling about that racist component not traveling well out of the South?
I think whenever there's progress made against racism, as we saw with Barack Obama being elected, there's always a backlash, and the backlash has been this Tea Party vehicle. And I think that As we go into the future of this movement, I think I don't think it's going to go much further than the South, to be honest. It's very divided. A lot of the sessions that they had at the conference were very unprofessional. It seemed like they didn't have a plan B. They had a lot of pullouts, and they didn't have any backup plan for speeches when some candidates and when some other speakers pulled out. And so a lot of the sessions for me were filler sessions. I call them filler sessions. They were how to use technology, how to use the internet, and it was really some pretty pointless exercises there.
Well, it felt a little amateurish. The not just the speech for that she gave Palin, but the Q&A was so sort of staged. And I understand that there are various groups there that didn't really agree. There were people calling to get down on their knees and pray, and there are other more secular people. Stephen, what could you see as the glue that kind of unites them, if indeed there were some divisions?
I think the only thing that unites them is a call for fiscal responsibility. At the event, yeah, a couple of the sessions were actually taken over by the attendees. The speakers were kind of almost shut down, and it just turned into a debate between the audience. And a lot of people were, you know, as you said, asking why, you know, why are we not praying before and after every session, before and after every meal? And then a lot of other people were asking, you know, asking about the leaders and who, you know, who's going to take over, and people were just really upset, and even a couple of the panelists were upset and publicly said it, that they didn't know where the movement was going, and they were they thought they came here with a vision, and that vision is not happening and not going through for them. At one point as well, there was on the last day there was a panel with three panelists and they were asked the question, should we endorse candidates? And two of the panelists said, absolutely, that's the only way this movement is going to go forward. We need to get behind candidates, pick out the best ones and get behind them, support them all the way. And that, whereas the other one of the third panelist got up and said, absolutely not. He said, if the Tea Party activists can't go and research candidates for themselves and they're just going to be force-fed candidates, then they shouldn't be in this movement. So I think there's a lot of divisions. And I think really fiscal responsibility would be the only thing that's keeping them together at this point.
And Max Blumenthal, it was so partisan, particularly Sarah Palin's speech, that it was sort of boilerplate partisan Republicans. Hard for me to understand how independents could pretend that this was anything but a Republican rally. You've been doing some research on this young Republican activist who managed to embarrass the Acorn people, and he's been a hero on Fox News. What's going on that front?
Well, his mentor, we're talking about James O'Keefe, who did the undercover Acorn videos and is out on bail now, along with some other young Republican mischief makers who worked with him at the Leadership Institute, this conservative cadre training institute in Northern Virginia that also trained wonderful people like Jack Abramoff. And his mentor, Ben Wetmore, was actually at the Tea Party convention in Nashville, out on bail, being hailed as a hero at the convention. There's a criminal class in the conservative movement that they're using to make mischief and to divide and attack liberals. And this is the spear tip of this. And I managed to dredge up a photograph of James O'Keefe, the maker of the Acorn videos,
and the guy that got busted in Mary Landrieu's office pretending to be a phone repairman.
Well, I don't have a photograph of him, but I have James O'Keefe at a white nationalist gathering in 2006 that was headlined by someone named Jared Taylor, the head of a white supremacist group, American Renaissance, which has been identified in the 2009 Virginia Terrorism Threat Assessment Report as a neo-Nazi terrorism group. He was invited by a fellow Leadership Institute intern named Marcus Epstein, who used to be Tom Tancredo's spokesman until he was arrested for karate chopping a black woman randomly in the streets of Washington while he was bar hopping and calling her the N-word. So these are the kind of kids that, you know, James O'Keefe's being hailed as a hero on O'Reilly, on Hannity, on Beck. These are the kind of kids that they're worshiping. This is the young generation of the Tea Party crowd and the conservative movement. And what they're doing is they're legitimizing criminality, because as long as liberals are in government, or Democrats, or an African American with a foreign background is the president of the United States, the entire government is illegitimate, and criminal acts against it, including attempted illegal espionage of Senator Mary Landrieu's office, are legitimate. They're not off bounds to the conservative movement, so they're fostering a criminal class. And we've seen it for the past 20 years, and it manifests in the corruption whenever they get in power and various bizarre scandals. And we're seeing it crop up again within this movement that's risen up in opposition to Obama and the Democratic Congress.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Pickett, did you get a whiff of that this thing could go beyond politics into a kind of more dangerous and you know, potentially brutal direction?
James O'Keefe's lawyer, yeah, he was there speaking, and he, a lot of people were very happy and very pleased with James O'Keefe and his actions over the past couple of months. And in terms of it going beyond and spreading into something dangerous, I think that can definitely happen. And what needs to happen is that liberals and progressives have not been stepping up to the plate to combat this. I think it's, you know, you have people like Lou Dobbs on the, you know, being on television for much, much, way too long with his, you know, saying racist things every night on his TV show, and we have no one stepping up to the plate and saying, you know, that this is wrong. 20 years ago, the things that were said at this conference over the weekend would not have flown, and I think until liberals and progressives step up and to the plate and try to get rid of this, then it's going to keep getting bigger and it's going to keep getting more dangerous.
I thank both of you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Max Blumenthal and Stephen Piggott. Thank you both.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, New York Times best-selling author, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, and Stephen Piggott, a research fellow with the Center for a New Community, a national organization committed to building community justice and equality. He's been in Tennessee where he got a first-hand experience of this so-called first Tea Party convention at which Tom Tancredo made an overtly racist opening speech, and at the keynote speech was given by Sarah Palin, which was just devastatingly stupid. And it's amazing to think that it is so clear that Sarah Palin probably was the main reason, one of the main contributing factors to why John McCain lost. So the idea that she could be the candidate in 2012 is of course a scary possibility to a lot of people. But it seems so unlikely, given her pathetic, rambling, and embarrassing speech, particularly when she referred to issues of national security. Surely this country could not make such a reckless choice to make this ridiculous woman the steward of the nuclear arsenal. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK is the number to call. I'm joined by Alan Minsky, and we're going to do some more. We're trying to give you as much programming as possible, but within the context of these 2 hours, we have to raise some money to keep this program going. And now is the time. We're joining an author who's written about this movement, and he'll be joining us in a little while. And then in the second hour, we'll be talking about the privatization of the U.S. government, and in the context of the intelligence world, where there are some very shadowy partnerships between the American intelligence services and corporate America, which we'll be examining. Thank you for joining us here, Alan. And do you have any words of encouragement to get these phone lines lit up?
Yeah, I sure do, because we have a book here we're offering called Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. I think anybody who thought that the era of cooperation was set to commence with the election of Barack Obama, or at least the era of productivity from a largely Democratic Congress and a Democratic White House was about to commence, certainly have been shocked. And instead, what we have is a seemingly a rising tide of right-wing populism, and certainly this weekend we have with the Tea Party Convention things really coming to a head in that regard, especially last night with Sarah Palin's address to the Tea Party Convention. So the book Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics takes on the issues of authoritarian streams in contemporary American politics and right-wing populism. It is by Jonathan Wehler, and it is available for a $125 pledge of support. We're about to have an interview with the author, but before we get to that, we want to see at least 9 people call right now, pledge their support to KPFK and Background Briefing, this exceptional show that for years here, Sunday at 11 a.m., has brought you the rejoinder to the Talking Head shows Sunday morning on television, where you get more depth, more insight, more reality as to what's transpiring in this society than you'll ever get on Face the Nation or Meet the Press. The number here is 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Jonathan Weiler's book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, a $125 pledge.
And indeed, we're one of the few areas in the media where we can actually speak the truth, and we don't have to be mediated. For whatever reasons, I don't know why ABC News cut out Tom Tancredo's racist reference to people who couldn't say the word vote in English. And I don't understand why everybody on CNN had such nice words about Sarah Palin's speech, when it would be clear to any sentient human being that this woman doesn't know what she's talking about. I understand that we have a crisis in education, and I understand that the country in many ways is becoming divided over those that are educated and those that are not. And if this movement becomes a Southern movement, then, you know, I suppose we should be thankful that demographically there are more people that will vote against Sarah Palin than would vote for her. But the part about it that's extraordinary is the supine nature of our media that refuses to provide any context, and that will insistently balance everything, no matter how absurd, with a pro and con argument, when in fact it cries out for the emperor's clothes question, you know, which is, what the hell is this woman doing? And why are we talking about her? In fact, why are we talking about her here now, Alan? I mean, it makes me ill to think that I'm wasting so much time talking about this absurd confection from Wasilla, Alaska.
818-985-5735. It is absolutely absurd. And one of the best ways to understand it is through, again, this book that we're offering up as a $125 pledge of support. We're about to talk to the author, but we still need about six of you to call. 818-985-5735. Pledge your support to Background Briefing for $125. Pick up Jonathan Weiler's book. And 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK is the number to call. We just want to see a few of you call in. That's only a little bit more than $10 a month to support KPFK and Background Briefing. There's another call right now. We just need five more people to call. We'll get to the interview. You'll hear about this fantastic book again. This is a guy who's blogged for years, and he's written on the Soviet Union and the rise of authoritarian populism in the Soviet Union, and now he has turned his attention to the subject here in the United States, and there is no doubt that we have seen that rising tide, that reaction to Barack Obama, and this looks with an unblinding eye at the realities we face now with the things like the Teabaggers movement. They're meeting in their convention right now this weekend, grabbing up all the headlines, even though they're just really just a handful of people there. They dominate the media. They dominate the media discourse. What is the relationship of things like Glenn Beck, again, to these just smattering of people who collect out in the streets, pales in terms of the size of the anti-war demonstrations, but dominates the media for years? Certainly that's a major thing, not the media here. Okay, we've gotten a whole number of people calling in. Let's just see two more people call, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Give one last pitch, and then we'll go to the interview.
Well, Alan, you have to take them a little more seriously, I think, because we've known for some time now that since Barack Obama got elected, there's been a huge uptick in the purchase of firearms. In fact, many, many gun shops have run out of weapons, and they've certainly, in many more occasions, run out of ammunition. So there's a kind of hoarding mentality, a bunker mentality out there in these ultra-conservative circles. So they may not be large in number, but they're certainly heavily armed. And the combination of that possibility and the overt hatred that is being spread by people like Glenn Beck, the incitement to violence that is more than implied in much of what he says, along with this pathetic, atavistic, weeping for the bygone days of Ozzie and Harriet, the simple America that Glenn Beck misses. Of course, what he's really saying there is that we want to go back to the days of Ozzie and Harriet, the early American dream, when Ronald Reagan was selling Chesterfields and blacks were invisible and Hispanics weren't even on the radar, except in the doing the lawns. So that's the message out there, and we're trying to have a little reality check here. in this part of the media that's not corporate controlled, very, very small sliver of the overall spectrum that's not corporate controlled, even in terms of public radio, there's a lot of paying the piper for being underwritten. This is the only network, not that it's a real network, but it's the only radio station that really doesn't take any corporate money. And that is what we're celebrating here and what we're proud of. And I hope that you acknowledge that acknowledge the fact that a few people are actually speaking truth about what's really happening here, particularly what happened in Nashville over the weekend. Now joined by, and again, 818-985-5735. Not that you don't know that number, but I'll give it to you again. 818-985-5735. There's still a couple of lines open. We are getting a lot of calls, and I'm very grateful for it because it does keep this program going here and keeps you connected to reality-based journalism and to an exploration of the issues before us that are real and that need to be attended to. There's enough problems in the world without making up ludicrous stuff. So let's deal with what we're really facing here. 818-985-5735. I'm speaking with Jonathan Weiler, who's a professor of international studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He previously blogged for the political website The Gadflyer and Sports Media Review and the award-winning The Starting Five and Newsom, the news portal for Radio 1, Interactive 1. His first book, Human Rights in Russia, A Darker Side of Reform, argues that the tumultuous processes associated with political and economic reform have, in important instances, worked to erode human rights in the post-Soviet Russia. His latest book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, takes on the issues of the authoritarian streams in contemporary American politics. And Jonathan, given that we've spoken earlier with somebody that was at the Tea Party convention and somebody that's been doing this kind of guerrilla journalism, gate-crashing all these extreme right-wing events, Max Blumenthal, and videotaping these encounters, there is a tendency amongst progressives to sort of find it all rather amusing. But given the nature of how many firearms they have and how angry these people are, do you consider this a classic right-wing movement in the ways that you have such movements in post-Soviet Russia and going back to the brown shirts?
Well, I thanks for having me in, and I just want to give a quickly note that my book is co-authored with Mark Hetherington, so I want to give him credit for that. But to your question, I think that this movement absolutely needs to be taken seriously. You know, if we look at our research, for example, among the people we consider the most authoritarian, we would say that something like 20% of the American population falls into that category. So 20% is already a significant chunk, and they become even more important when they all coalesce in one particular political party, as they have over the past 20 years or so in the Republican Party. So they now make up an important part of the base of one of our two political parties. So I think they're far from a fringe, and in that respect need to be taken very seriously.
And we were talking earlier also about the extent to which this a gathering in Nashville at which Sarah Palin gave the keynote address, it seems as though her function, Palin's function on the McCain ticket, because you know McCain really wanted to have his friend Joe Lieberman on the ticket, but the Republican Party said no way, and you've got to put somebody on the ticket who's going to bring the right in because they're kind of feeling surly and disaffected. So they found this woman who turned out to be the absolute darling of the American right. And she, it seems like, not only was her function in the last election to bring the right-wing vote in for McCain, it seems her new role is to bring the fractious far right of the Republican Party into the fold, even though they're all pretending that everybody that's meeting there is an independent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, Ian, one thing I want to say about Sarah Palin is that she fits very well with what we describe in the book as a particular cognitive style that appeals to authoritarians. And, you know, that style is based on seeing the world in very clear and black and white terms and reducing complexity to its simplest elements. And however ridiculous those of us think Sarah Palin are for the way she talks and thinks about the world. It's very clear why her particular way of articulating reality appeals so much to this base, because she does speak in clear black and white terms about good, about evil, about what's right, about what's wrong. She reduces things to their simplest elements. And this is a style that appeals to, as I said, a not inconsiderable chunk of the American public. And I should say one more thing, which is that even though a lot of the people that she appeals to might be low education voters, it's not strictly true that authoritarians are low in education. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, about John Roberts, who sits on the Supreme Court of the United States, and I think by most measures is a highly educated, highly intelligent guy, and yet he also has a clear need to reduce what I think most people consider very complex issues to their simplest elements. And I think this is a very important part of what's at the heart of the current right wing in the United States.
But isn't there a sort of anti-intellectualism there that George W. Bush, of course, got elected on? I mean, remember, he was up against a bona fide intellectual, Al Gore, who managed to lose three debates to this kind of homespun guy you wanted to have a beer with. So there's no question that anti-intellectualism works, and it's also, conversely, it's easy to paint the so-called elite as elitists. But I never thought that that was really in the political DNA of America, that particularly when you consider the extraordinary group of people that formed the revolution. Mm-hmm. So when did Americans, I always thought, and in fact most people in the political, most voters vote for people they think are qualified. Mm-hmm. But what's happening in America now is that you don't vote for people who are more qualified and more educated than you are. You vote for people that are just like you. So when did that happen?
Well, that's a good question. I think to some degree, this is a function of, and you and Alan were just talking about this a couple of minutes ago, this is a function of, I think, a media culture that's really promoted the idea of celebrity. And I think one sort of odd effect of promoting celebrity in all realms of life, including politics, is this idea that we're all sort of on the same level, and the idea that you try to bring people down, even big celebrities, to your level and understand them in their sort of most mundane, behaviors. So I think that's one issue. But I think another issue, more specifically related to politics, is that we've always had authoritarians in the United States. Okay, it's not like there are more authoritarian-minded folks now than there were, say, 50 years ago. In fact, there's probably somewhat less. But what's changed is that the authoritarians, for a variety of reasons over the last 40 years or so, have increasingly gravitated toward the Republican Party. And what that's meant is that it's no longer just a bunch of individuals who tend to think in more simple and black and white terms about reality. It's now an entire political party whose base is clamoring for that kind of thing. And the consequence is that that party is increasingly articulating a message that is as simple and reductive as possible. And it's one reason why, I know people have pointed this out about the Tea Partiers, and I'd say this is true about the Republican Party more generally. They don't even really have a policy program anymore. What they have is a set of visceral reactions to things that they hate, whether it's a black supposedly foreign-born president or the idea of socialist government or whatever it might be. We're not even talking about policy debates any longer. Now we're talking about visceral, gut-level reactions to people's hatred and resentment. And again, that's not new in American politics, but it's gathering in one particular place. The Republican Party is new, and it's why that way of thinking about things is so amplified now.
And how much do you think that Barack Obama, as our earlier guest, one of whom was at the Tea Party convention in Nashville, that this idea that we have of this African-American leader has become a kind of galvanizing force for this movement? At the time that Obama was elected, I think a lot of people throughout this country felt good about themselves and good about their country. So what happened to that feeling? And is that still the majority feeling as opposed to these bitter, angry people? Because much of what you hear about Obama that comes from Beck and O'Reilly and that the sort of hate machine at Fox News is made up. I mean, they've made up that he's an alien. They've made up. Tancredo called him a committed socialist ideologue. I mean, tell that to American progressives. They're mad as hell about him. They think he's a centrist and a sellout. So almost everything about him, that his birth certificate and lack thereof and all this made-up stuff, seems to be an excuse to give them permission to hate him, not because he's black, but because, you know, he's un-American. He hangs pals around with terrorists, as Palin says, and supports child molesters. I mean, they will not stop in making up stuff about Barack Obama.
Well, I think that's right. I would say a couple of things. The first thing I would say is that if it were Hillary Clinton who were elected in the fall of 2008 rather than Barack Obama, I don't actually think there would be a dramatically different landscape right now. We would still have a Tea Party movement. They would still have their incredible visceral anger about what they see as this declining America and getting away from what you described earlier as the, you know, the blissful times of Ozzie and Harriet. But I do think that there are things about Obama that just add a little more intensity to this underlying simmering anger. The fact that he's African American, the fact that he has a name that's not readily recognizable as a quote-unquote typical American name, the fact that his own style of speaking is so nuanced and subtle and in shades of gray, et cetera, and as you say, in ways that are actually maddening to progressives also, but I think are particularly offensive to this authoritarian way of thinking about the world. So they just see him as this kind of slick, clever guy. So I think that the sort of broader ideological or personality-based landscape that we're describing, that would be happening regardless of which Democrat won in 2008. But I do think Obama, because of who he is and because of what he looks like and because of what his name sounds like, does add a little more oomph to all of that.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Weiler, whose book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, we're offering up for $125 donation to Background Briefing at 818-985-575. This is a book from Cambridge University Press, a serious analysis of this political movement in this country that the Tea Party is galvanizing and appears to be it's not the juggernaut that the press would tell you it is, but it is certainly having an effect, and it's certainly having probably more of an effect on the Republican Party. That's not to say that it hasn't already had an effect on the Democratic Party, particularly in the race that took place in Massachusetts, even though Scott Brown is a Republican and is in fact a moderate Republican. He's the very Republican rhino that the Tea Party people hate, and yet they embraced him and took credit for the race. But what is clear on the Democratic side is that they're losing the white male vote. And it seems to me that this is a real challenge, and I'd like to get your sense on how the Democrats could navigate this. Underlying a lot of this anger and hatred and the alienation of white working class males from the Democratic Party is to do with things like affirmative action and the demographics, the changing demographics. By 2042, whites will be minority in this country. And so it seems to me that on the one hand, you have to acknowledge that that disquiet. At the same time, you can't indulge the racism. So how does the Democratic Party step up and create a narrative that brings these people back into the fold without in any way indulging their incipient racism?
Well, I think one answer to that question is that the Democratic Party has to be much more forceful than perhaps they're capable of being about the economic interests that they will fight for and that they represent. You know, a lot of these white working class voters, you asked about, you know, the 2008 election, a lot of these white working class voters, I think, did have discomfort about Obama because of his background or a variety of other reasons, but were willing to give him a chance because they were so unhappy with the economic circumstances that they were facing personally and that the country was facing more generally. And I think the Democrats' sort of irresoluteness in the face of what's gone on in the past year and a half has been, it's been bad policy and it's been bad politics. You know, the fact that only the day after Scott Brown was elected did Obama appear with Paul Volcker, who he had essentially marginalized for a year when Volcker was calling for more stringent regulations against the banks. And, you know, that's one part of their platform. The extent that you can say the Tea Party has any platform, this kind of resentment about the big banks that the Democrats had no reason not to take seriously, you know, except for the fact that they get too much of their own financing from the financial sector. So I think taking economic populism seriously and fighting on that is one answer to your question. I also think that, as you say, the demographic realities in this country are unmistakable. And I think in the long run, they're going to put the Republican Party in an impossible position because the Republicans will not be able to win by only appealing to white voters. And at this point, that's about all they're appealing to. And I think the Democrats, conversely, need to embrace that future and not run away from it. And I think one reason they are running away from it to some degree is that there are guys in the Democratic Party like Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman who I don't think in any meaningful sense represent the future but are having an outsized influence on the party's policies and political direction right now. So I think both embracing that demographic future and embracing economic populism are keys for the Democrats going forward.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Jonathan Wyler, and for your book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. We're very grateful for it and grateful for the ability to be able to offer this up. I understand you can assign some copies, too, so that's even a greater bonus. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Jonathan Wyler. He's a professor of international studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And he's written this book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, which is published by Cambridge University Press, a serious analysis of the political phenomenon that we're talking about here in following the Tea Party convention in Nashville over this weekend, with Sarah Palin giving the keynote address and Tom Tancredo opening it up with a mean and nasty racist speech. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. I'm joined by Alan Minsky, and we've got 10 minutes left before we go into our second hour. We'll be talking about the privatization of the American government and particularly national security, particularly in terms of the shadowy relationship between the CIA, other intelligence agencies, and corporate America in terms of industrial espionage.
818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 is the number here. 818-985-KPFK. For a $125 pledge of support, pick up Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. We need 30 of you to call in the next 10 minutes for us to get back on track here. We have a great hour coming up. We want to get to it as soon as possible. I could not think of something that is more appropriate for the current American political landscape than picking up Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics by Jonathan Wyler and Mark Hetherington. Thought that was an incredibly illuminating conversation Ian just had. And I do want to say again, another instance, there's so many, they just sort of come pouring in, but here is a clear instance of how KPFK is so different than all the other media outlets. I mean, talk about not being able to talk about a serious, real political event and recognizing it for what it is, describing it, analyzing it, both in terms of just your visceral reaction to it, I'm talking about the Tea Party convention now, and an in-depth analysis of it. You don't get it anywhere else in the media, but you get it right here at KPFK, and you get it right here on Background Briefing. I mean, this is a highly significant event that's taking place. Think of all the right-wing populism throughout American history. Think of right-wing populism throughout recent global history, and think about the Tea Party. And then think about the way that it is just cuddly embraced right now. Think about what's happening on the Super Bowl, by the way, with Tim Tebow. I mean, talk about trying to get...
That's the anti-abortion ad.
Ad that's going on in the Super Bowl. They couldn't move on, was not allowed to go on to the Super Bowl. They said that's advocacy, but Tim Tebow is allowed to go on there. A right-wing Christian fundamentalist quarterback from the University of Florida wears the Bible quotes underneath his eyes wherever he plays. You know, well, free speech, he's allowed to do it, but the progressives weren't allowed to, and they're allowed to. So what's going on in the media with this embrace of this right-wing populism? Well, not here at KPFK, and a great way to understand this is the seminal work, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, by Jonathan Weiler and Mark Hetherington, available for $125 pledge of support. We still need 25 more of you to call, 818-985-5735. It is $125 pledge of support. Just $125, that's a little more than $10 a month, and you keep this radio station, the only station that can call this like we see it, 818-985-5735.
And indeed, the ad in today's Super Bowl is entirely put together by Focus in the Family, the Reverend, so-called Reverend Dobson. In fact, I meant to talk to Max about that. He had some angles on it since he studied, Blumenthal studied this Focus on the Family movement for some time. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. We've only got a little bit of time left before we start in the second hour of Background Briefing to talk about industrial espionage and a completely unknown area. We always talk about the Chinese stealing from Google and every American corporation, and we don't talk about does the United States get involved in economic espionage? Yeah, and we'll be talking about it, and who's doing it, and it's a very interesting story, and I look forward to that. But in the meantime, we've got to close this hour out and raise some money, and we're way behind, and I know you're all tied up and tired, and you've got compassion fatigue from Haiti, etc.
Ready to root for the Saints.
And
Colts fans, call too, 818-985-5735.
Right.
818-985-KPFK.
I don't have a dog in this fight now that the Vikings lost.
I'll give you one. The Saints quarterback Drew Brees wrote a pro-union, anti-NFL ownership op-ed in the Washington Post. He is the most vocal contemporary advocate, not only for the rights of the players within the NFL, and boy, are they brutalized in that sport. It is not like baseball. You're not talking about 15, 20-year careers. You're talking about the average NFL career being like under 3 years, and the people come out brutalized.
Right.
Okay? I mean, the kickers and the quarterbacks are anomalies. And, you know, there's so much talent coming out of college football. These guys are quite abused. And Drew Brees also supports the rights of the fans and says how the NFL owners are just absolutely just devastating the fans in terms of how they're trying to have the Supreme Court rule in their rights. So Drew Brees, union activist, there you go, New Orleans Saints quarterback.
It's not hard to hate that idiot owner. I mean, these obnoxious billionaires. Now, this guy.
There's one great owner.
He tried to bail on the entire city and threatened to move it to Houston or somewhere. I can't remember.
Right. They're all like that.
And now, of course, he's saying, oh, no, we're really all for the Big Easy, you know.
Okay. Well, first of all, we need phone answerers down here, too. 3729 Cahuenga Boulevard West, okay? Right now, the phone lines were full. Now they're open again. So 818-985-5735. We need 20 more of you to call right now. We'll get to the next interview. There's another call. So just 19 more callers right now. If you're in the neighborhood, come on down to KPFK. We're going to have a busy next hour here with Ian. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. Come on down, answer phones, call right now for $125, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, Critique of the Rising Right-Wing Populism in America, 818-985-5735, $125 pledge of support. Now, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming around the world at www.kpfk.org. The phone lines are lighting up. If you're having trouble getting through, you know, keep calling, call on back for $125. It's all we're offering up. Oftentimes things are a lot more on Sunday midday to support the station. This is a very thorough, deep analytical work about the psychology of right-wing populism in America. I think if you heard the conversation Ian had with Jonathan Weiler, you saw the intense level of insight. Just broke down the appeal of Sarah Palin in fitting her into the model of the contemporary right-wing backlash around the world and in the United States of America. 818-985-5735. It's real. It is frightening. They're out there. We have to understand it. We have to understand it both in terms of its emotional impact. We also have, I mean, you know, just being able to, vis-a-vis George Lakoff, just being able to deconstruct the argument in a rational manner, that's one thing, but also understanding the other trappings that go with this. This book does both of those, authoritarianism and polarization in American politics. The lines were full. Now there are three lines open, so now's the time to call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We still have two lines open, and we need about, I'd say about 16 more people to call right now in the next few minutes, and we will be at least close to being on track for what is only a two-hour show. Oftentimes we do 3 hours. This today we're just
usually
doing 2 hours.
Usually we do 3 hours.
We keep you in here as long as
and
possible.
And I can actually watch the Super Bowl. I don't have to do the third hour. I actually, you know, I thought the Super Bowl was on last week.
I mentioned
that.
I heard you say that. Yeah. Yeah. So you're so immersed in each segment you do, you're blind to these other.
I guess I don't cut it as a joke.
We've had some good sports segments on recently, and you know, the politics.
Actually, the guy I had on the other day writes the ESPN blog.
Right,
Easterbrook. And I forgot to ask him who he wanted.
And the guy you just had on writes about sports, too. Read down into his biography. He's also a sports blogger, Jonathan Weiler. 818-985-5735, 818-98. Sports can be political, indeed. 818-985-5735. In fact, I'm very interested, at least for a few months, in developing a show around the World Cup. The People's Sport on the People's Station. Think about it, folks. Maybe bilingual, English and Spanish, half an hour a week, and then having daily reports on the soccer of the world's largest spectacle event, the World Cup, taking place this summer in South Africa. Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics by Jonathan Weiler and Mark Hetherington is still our featured premium. Right now, we have three lines open. We need about 13 more people to call, and we'll get on to the next interview. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. We're catching up here, Ian. We got a little bit of maybe three more minutes here. We need about 11 more people to call. 818-985-5735. These things are flying off the shelves.
Right.
We right now have
maybe
one line
people
open.
Should cut back on their sports bets today. Throw a little money our way.
Well, I'm sure. The Colts are a machine. I mean,
so what's the point spread? You know,
I'm not sure, but it's the Colts must be favored. And chances are, there's so much emotion behind the Saints that's lowering it. I would think the wise money would go with taking the spread and putting the money on the Colts.
Well,
I'll be rooting for
the Saints.
I think
the wiser money would be to send some our way. 818-985-5735.
Well, you just got a great tip here from a guy who's written 4 books on sports. Me. And I think that because of that, you should send money to KPFK. You listen here. We make you some money. You give the money back to us. It all sort of flows, you know, the economy, et cetera, this invisible hand, yada, yada, yada. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
Trickle down.
No, a trickle over here. Look, actually, we jest, but again, KPFK and Ian so well is one of the voices that really breaks down the reality of American politics, the power dynamics behind the economy. You don't get anywhere else. You know, and if people are out there listening and they hear me talk about authoritarianism and polarization in American politics, okay, how do we distinguish ourselves? Not just a few times I've spoken about how we distinguish ourselves from NPR recently, and that's pretty clear to everybody. Well, what about something like Air America, or what was called Air America, the other progressive talk radio station? We have depth. Do you think we'd ever get professors from the University of North Carolina who've written the book, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, on shows where you pretty much just have the same host doing monologues in their 8-minute segments interrupted by their 6 minutes of commercials? No, only here do we go into depth. We not only, again, provide the visceral response that all of us feel in our gut when we watch the Tea Party convention, but real depth into understanding the phenomenon and all of its complexity only on KPFK Radio, 818-985-5735. We just need about 8 more of you to call. We have two lines open right now. You can get through 818-985-5735 for $125 pledge of support. Authoritarian and Polarization in American Politics by Jonathan Weiler and Mark Hetherington tackles two fundamental problems in the study of contemporary American politics, the polarization of the electorate and the role of ideology in directing the political choices of ordinary citizens, bringing to view the deep psychological roots of political belief and behavior and the rise of the right wing. 818-985-5735. Call right now, $125 pledge of support, Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. We still need eight more of you to call. Call right now, $125 pledge. We have only 2 minutes left, so call right now. Get us back on track. We've been behind in terms of reaching our goal for today. We need you to call in, support Background Briefing, this unique show, this huge hit we've had here on KPFK, the rejoinder to the Talking Heads every Sunday, Face the Nation, Meet the Press. Here we have depth and real analysis of the society. Keep those phone lines calling.
818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK is the number to call. A few more calls, and then we'll be talking with Janine Waddell, the author of The Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market, a book that we will be offering up here for $125 donation to Background Briefing. And then following that, we'll talk with the author of a brand new book just out. By the way, The Shadow Elite has been the Huffington Post Book of the Month for the last month. And this new book just out, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, we'll be talking about that in the second part of the hour. I'm now speaking with Dr. Janine Waddell, who writes about the privatization of public and foreign policy, corruption and the state, and development and foreign aid through the unique lens of a social anthropologist. She's a four-time Fulbright scholar and has also won awards from the National Science Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the United States Institute for Peace. She's a professor in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University and a fellow at the New American Foundation. And her new book, Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market, has been, for the last month, the Huffington Post Book of the Month. Thank you so much for joining us, Janine. We've spoken a couple of times in the past, and it seems that every day there is something that's going on in the news that indicates to me that your thesis is as scary as it is about this marriage between corporate power and government, the privatization of our public spaces, seems to continue inexorably. And even in the case of the next subject following you, the world of economic espionage.
Well, thanks for having me again on the show, let me say first. And second, unfortunately, I'm afraid you're right that my thesis, scary as it is, seems to continue to show itself. Evidence, it seems, every day is available to bear out the thesis. The thesis of the book and shows us examples of this new breed of players that have gained power and influence over the past two decades, who are unelected, often even unappointed or in quasi-official roles, but wield enormous power and influence over public policy in so many different fields, from healthcare in the economy to foreign policy and finance.
Well, it seems to me that in terms of finance, I think we all should have been able to see it as clear as day, that a small group of people on Wall Street were able to create a private casino, create their own chips, leverage them to the sky, soak a bunch of money out of poor people aspiring to the middle class and to join what George W. Bush referred to as the ownership society. Now their houses are foreclosed on, a lot of them are sleeping in their cars. Meanwhile, all the money that was taken from these people in this kind of reverse Robin Hood was used, leveraged, through derivatives and other obscure and secret instruments, was able to be leveraged into a huge kind of bubble, a Ponzi, if you will, which exploded. And then what happens? The taxpayer then rewards these people, and an enormous, enormous, unprecedented amount of private debt becomes public debt. We end up holding the toxic assets. They're now bigger and stronger than ever, these Wall Street banks, and they could give a damn. And I think it's making people crazy, and it's a big part of what's motivating this Tea Party movement.
Right. It seems that way. It seems that way. I was watching just some excerpts from the Tea Party convention yesterday, and it seems that that's one of the major themes. Of course, there are others, but that theme really resonates. And far from creating what, as you pointed out, George W. Bush called an ownership society, in fact, what has been created and what continues to be created is what has been called government Sachs. Of course, Sachs for Goldman Sachs and government for government, so government Sachs. And that term really symbolizes this interlocking handful of Wall Street government policy deciders who work together at the highest echelons of power and influence. And, you know, whether it's those who ruined Enron or those who brought about more recent wreckage on Wall Street, one of the features of this group is a lack of loyalty to institutions, whether it's to the institutions, that is, that they supposedly work for, whether it's business, and therefore they're not thinking, they don't have the shareholders' interests in mind, the best interests of the shareholders, or whether it's government, they don't have the public in mind. So that does these interlocking closed, you know, or semi-closed networks of these policy deciders, that does seem to characterize the way decisions major decisions like what should happen with the economy does seem to characterize how things are being done these days. And what is happening, as you said just a couple of minutes ago, is that you're getting greater interdependency between public and private power, between government and corporations. We're getting they're becoming more dependent on each other, and where is the public interest in this? That's the problem.
Well, Janine, I don't know whether you watched the Sarah Palin speech at the Tea Party convention, but her theme, and it's consistent with the right wing of the Republican Party, and it goes back to Ronald Reagan, is this banter of getting government off your back, and government is too big. And I wish that somebody on the left of the spectrum would point out the real record is that this is not a struggle between bigger and smaller government. It should be a struggle between better government and government that's more responsive to the taxpayer. But what has inexorably been happening for the last many decades is that the government has been slowly taken over and privatized. And that is the point of your book. And I'm astounded that people fall for this mantra time and time again. And she was
Exactly. And I did watch part of her speech, and certainly she was talking precisely about that issue when I did tune in. And I am also just astonished that people both on the right and left get away with this false debate, which is a debate about big government versus small government. Let me say a bit about what is actually been going on in the past few years, and where we are right now. Now, 3/4 of people who actually work for federal government, who are on the federal government dole, as it were, are actually work for private contractors. They're actually working for private companies. 3/4 of people working for federal government are actually working for companies. And this isn't just people who are doing, say, food service or gardening or the print shop. These are people who are carrying out crucial government functions. And many of these are in the national security arena. Many of them are in homeland security. A lot of Homeland Security is a largely outsourced agency. Defense Department, there's a huge amount of outsourcing that goes on there. This, the outsourcing of government functions, not services, services too, but functions is where my concern is. That's now routine. Contractors, they oversee and they choose other contractors. They control crucial databases. They draft official documents. They run intelligence operations, not to mention execute military and occupational operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Of course, we know that there are more contractors in Afghanistan and in Iraq than there are military personnel. There are more contractors paid by the U.S. government in Afghanistan and Iraq than there are U.S. government military, U.S. military personnel. So, and I've done, you know, quite a bit of research, just looking at reports by the government accountability, the GAO, the government accountability office and inspectors general of various, of government agencies. And in report after report, government investigators are raising questions about who really sets policy. Is it government or is it contractors? And whether government has the information and the expertise and the institutional memory and the people to manage contractors, or is it the other way around? And the upshot of this is that it's, one really has to wonder whether our democracy, supposedly the world's model democracy, can be counted on to act in the public interest and in the national interest. I mean, where is the national interest in all of this? And what I'm getting back to is that when people talk about big government versus small government, I think that is a false debate. And why is that a false debate? Because through all of this bipartisan talk, Democrats and Republicans talk about limiting government and keeping it small. For 50 years, this has been a bipartisan conversation. What has in fact happened to government? It has only gotten bigger. And the reason that it's gotten bigger, but it's gotten less accountable, because what has happened is that in order to look like government is being limited, what politicians have done is they've put limits on the number of people, officials who can actually be hired, the number of bureaucrats who can be hired. But the needs keep growing and growing and growing, and people want government services, as it turns out. People seem to want, you know, Social Security and education and all these things, for better or for worse. And so what happens is in defense. So what happens is all of this stuff gets contracted out, but it gets, and so government actually grows. It's kind of ersatz, it's de facto government. It grows and grows and grows. But it's less accountable than if actual, you know, bureaucrats are doing it, because when you're working for a company, as opposed to the government, when you're working for the government, your first responsibility is to the government. It is to be accountable to the people, right? And the Congress is supposed to oversee that. When you're working for a company, your first responsibility is to the shareholders, and that's the way it should be. If I'm a shareholder in a company, I want to know that that I'm going to make money, right? But where is my loyalty if I'm working for a contractor who does government work? My loyalties are not necessarily to the people, to the government, when push comes to shove, right?
No, I agree. And in fact, I think we have an incredibly clear example of what you're trying to tell us here, Janine. Again, Janine Waddell, the author of Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. The Obama White House is now trying to, part of their reform efforts, are trying to make student loans cheaper and more available. And what happens is that the federal government lends out, under the Bush regime, the federal government lends out money to these private entities that are crony connected and simply are just a shingle held up, no particular expertise. Then they then charge the students a lot more for their own overhead. And the efforts to be reformed now are getting bogged down in the Congress, because lobbyists for these parasites are now weighing in. So, you know, a big part of what you've uncovered here is quite simply what the mafia calls vigorish. It's a layer. It's an unnecessary layer between the taxpayer and the government services. And,
right.
And it's just a huge ripoff when you think about it.
Right. Right, and so it means that we as citizens get fewer services, and they're often not as good. They cost, you know, they very often cost more, and the companies that are doing the work, it's not as if they are really private sector companies in the traditional sense. They don't have the best qualities of the private sector. I mean, the private sector, what is supposed to make it good is that it is competitive, that you, if you're a company, you have to compete with another company. But see, these companies often have sole source contracts. They don't have to compete for the work, number one. Number two, some of them, the only thing they do is work for the government. So they don't have any, you know, where are the incentives that they should have to operate in the free market? They don't have them.
Right.
So in fact, we're making you know, some corporations more intertwined, more dependent on government. It's a kind of, you know, it's a welfare system in the classic sense.
It's sort of right wing welfare.
Yeah, and this, and meanwhile, the shadow government keeps growing. And I have the numbers in front of me. The cost of services alone, so that's, you know, that's consulting, that's all of the services that these contractors provide, went up from $125 billion in 2001 to more than 320 billion in 2008. So from that's how big this contracting sector, the government, mm-hmm. federal government contractors, from in 2001 they only got got $125 billion. To 2008 they get $320 billion plus. That's almost, you know, that's, they're on the way to doubling that figure in the course of what, 7 years?
Right. Well, just
90% of NASA and Department of Energy's budget go to private contractors.
Well, just in closing, Janine, again, the author of Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market, a book we're offering up here for support of Background Briefing. We're going to be talking to Ayman Javers in a moment, the author of the new book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage. I know you've mentioned the book in the Huffington Post in terms of its how it illustrates your thesis of these shadowy private-public partnerships.
Right. Well, this is a story of CIA agents who are moonlighting in their spare time and hiring themselves out via a company to Wall Street companies and hedge funds. So this is the kind of, you know, sort of government guns for hire circumstance that creates precisely the kind of circumstances for players who, you know, for big time players who do have divided loyalties, and who play these overlapping and not fully disclosed roles and parade themselves around as operating in the public interest, claim to be operating in the public interest, but we really have no way of knowing because they're playing so many different roles and they're not saying what they are. So this is a case of CIA officers moonlighting for their own, you know, to bolster their own pocketbooks, and playing multiple roles and with potentially divided loyalties, whose fundamental mission, I mean, the mission of the CIA is supposed to be to protect Americans. So this does point towards a disturbing trend that I examine in Shadow Elite, where you have power brokers and supposed public servants who have you know, who carry on these many and ever fluid involvements, but without traditional checks and balances.
Well, Janine, I'm afraid we've run out of time here. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad that we're able to offer up your book here as a premium in our fund drive.
Thank you so much.
I know we've spoken before, and your book's definitely made a difference, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You.
Hello again, Amy and Masters. I just speaking then with Janine Waddell, the author of Shadow Elite, How the World's New Power Brokers Undermine Democracy, Government, and the Free Market. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. You can get that book for a $125 donation to Background Briefing.
818-985-5735. Again, this book is all over the Huffington Post. They've been featuring it this last month, how the world's new power brokers undermine democracy, government, and the free market. It is a $125 pledge of support to KPFK. Right now, we're going to go on to the next interview, but we're not going to get there until we have about 15 people call. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And again, Janine Waddell's book, The Shadow Elite, available for a $125 pledge of support. There's a call. We just need 14 more people to call, and we'll go on to the next interview. Ian, we're a little bit behind in terms of reaching our goal. We want to make sure that we can push forward and get this fund drive done as fast as possible, returning to our regular coverage here on KPFK, which is so important for all of us to do. Ian on the daily briefing and here Sundays on the background briefing.
818-985-5735 is the number to call, 818-985-KPFK. We've tried to give you as much content here today as we can in balancing it out with the need to raise money. This is a program where I reach out to people all around the world, trying to find the best person available to talk about whatever's happening in the news, to try and find some other way to get into the story not just in terms of the process that seems to be the way that most of the stories are dealt with by television news and by newspapers and certainly by cable news. It's constantly talking about the process. And if you go change the dial between ABC, CBS, and NBC's evening news, you'll find that not only the story is identical, they're all usually in the same order. So there has got to be other ways to try and approach and analyze the news. And also, because we are truly fearless here, since we don't have to pay the piper, we don't have to we have no corporate underwriting, that we can actually talk about and examine and expose these vast, powerful forces that are taking over our lives. We are getting sick and ill and overweight and from corporate food. Corporate entertainment is coarsening our culture. Corporate information is dominating the news through infotainment. And if they do take over the internet, that will be the last avenue of the exchange of ideas and free speech in this country. So I think we're on the honorable side here. Of the people versus the powerful. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Support this program. It's an important vote of confidence for reality-based information here at this radio station. There's enough craziness on the right from Glenn Beck without imitating it on the left. We're actually trying to provide you with real information that's connected to reality and that could help you navigate this complicated world that we live in. It's bad enough that there are all kinds of mendacity going on, but we certainly don't have to make up stuff. There's plenty of stuff that's real to deal with. 818-985-5735.
Again, we need 11 more people to call, and we'll get on to the next interview. Janine Waddell's The Shadow Elite is a $125 pledge of support. Waddell has pulled together a shocking expose of those dismantling U.S. democracy from the inside. Labeling the new operators Flexions, she finds individual roles as lobbyists, government insiders, or elected officials converging into a single network, quote, snaking through official and private organizations, creating a loop to close the democratic processes. They create tailored truth, benefiting the highest bidder. We need 10 more people to call at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Pick up this book, The Shadow Elite, featured on the Huffington Post as the book of the month for the past month, I believe. Janine Waddell's The Shadow Elite, 818-985-5735. That's $125 pledge of support. The book that we featured last hour that really flew out of here like hotcakes was Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. That also is $125 pledge. Get them both for $250 at 818-985-5735. We need just 9 more callers right now, and we'll get on to the next interview. Very exciting stuff that very much complements Janine Waddell's book, The Shadow Elite. 818-985-5735.
818-985-KPFK, 818-985-5735. 5735 is the number to call. And again, we're trying to give you as much as possible of content. Coming up, we've got this interesting story, which I've been wanting to talk about for some time, because we're often critical of the Chinese, who we know we've covered stories about their hacking into Google and hacking into the U.S. Government's mainframes. And the question's always hanging is, does anybody on the American side do economic espionage? Well, we'll be answering that question very shortly. 818-985-5735 is the number to call. And hopefully we get a couple more numbers. We need to get Eamon Javers on the line do the interview. So
we just need seven more people to call now, and 818-985-5735, but we're getting him on the line. We need you to call right now. You'll be done in the phone room in a couple minutes. There are just six more people to call right now. 818-985-5735, call in. We now have about 14 people in the phone room, and we don't have all those lines filled up. There goes another call coming in. Oh, no, that one drops. So let's say six more calls still we need. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. The Shadow Elite by Janine Waddell, $125 pledge of support to KPFK. Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, that itself was $125. Together, they're $250. 818-985-5735. Also for $125, the book we're about to hear about, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy by Eamon Javers. Again, Janine Waddell's The Shadow Elite, an amazing expose on the people who are dismantling U.S. democracy from the inside out. We just need five more people to call right now at 818-985-5735. You will be the person out there that will spark our next segment if you call right now. We're getting a flood of calls coming in right now, but we still need about four more people to call. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. That's a little over $10 a month, $125, and you'll be supporting Background Briefing and KPFK Radio. Okay, we're getting a flurry of calls. Are you ready to take it away, Ian?
Indeed I am, and do keep calling 818-985-5735. And not only do we welcome those with deep pockets, we also, for a minimum of $25, you can join the station. So don't feel that the People's Radio is in any way depending upon deep pockets.
And before I slip away, if any of you want to step up and put a matching pledge down for our last pitch coming up, challenging people, throw down a few thousand dollars and say, here we go. This is not going to be given to the station unless it is matched, say, in a 10-minute frame. Call right now, 818-985-5735. That way, you'll be as good as doubling your money when you set that on the table, and you can make sure that people stand up and support your favorite radio station.
Thank you, Alan. I'm speaking with Eamon Javers, who's covered Washington, the White House, and the intersection of government and Wall Street for a number of journals, including Politico and Business Week, among others. As Washington correspondent for Business Week magazine, he wrote extensively about the Jack Abramoff scandal, and Javers unearthed the fact that Abramoff had made under-the-table payments to political columnists in exchange for favorable coverage of his clients, investigative work for which he won the Medill School of Journalism's Award of Distinction. His new book, just out, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, we're offering up here for $125 donation to this program, the Background Briefing. And I appreciate having you on, Eamon, and I'm certainly grateful for your book, which is just out. And I have, as I mentioned earlier to the audience, that you know, we were talking recently about the Google story in China, the extent to which the Chinese government is active in foreign, their foreign intelligence doesn't make a distinction between strategic military intelligence and economic espionage. They seem to be, of all the intelligence services in the world, the most integrated in that sense. And the British government recently warned its businessmen not to to be aware that they were being penetrated on a constant basis, and every time a company, American corporation, goes over there, essentially their intellectual material is grabbed if possible. And when you think about the U.S. economy, what it really depends upon now, since we've lost our manufacturing base, is intellectual property, whether it's movies like James Cameron's Avatar or the secret formula for a big pharma. It all comes down, and certainly all the Silicon Valley companies are all, the high-tech companies are all about intellectual property. So if you pull back and look at our economy and the direction in which it's heading, if we don't protect our intellectual property, we could become a second or third-rate power pretty quickly, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the world today, I mean, economic espionage can be as powerful as, you know, old-fashioned military espionage, particularly in this global economy that we all live in. I mean, my book is about companies spying on other companies, but I tell you, as I was doing the research for it, I was talking to some U.S. intelligence officials, and they told me a story where they had found a fascinating thing going on. Somewhere on the internet, somebody had set up a fake executive recruiting website. So this is a website dressed up as if it was a company that was looking for executives to hire. And emails were going out with this company's address to executives at American defense contractors and high-tech companies. And they think maybe thousands of emails had gone out, all fake, but all praising these executives and saying they were great recruits and they might make an excellent hire for another company. Wouldn't they care to have a conversation about what it was they did for a living? And my intelligence sources said that this whole thing was a dummy operation set up, they think, they have no proof, but they think, by Chinese intelligence, just fishing by the thousands for executives at American companies who'd be willing to leak some kind of technical details, thinking that they were in line for a great new job and that never realizing it was all a put-up job.
So in terms of having established Eamon Javers, again, the author of Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, a book just out that we're offering up here today for a donation to Background Briefing, the idea that having established that China is extremely aggressive in this area, I find it hard to believe that the United States is totally flat-footed. So can you give us a sense of what's going on? I know the CIA denies that they do any economic espionage.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, U.S. intelligence has always said that the United States does not engage in economic espionage against other countries. Other countries do it all the time, though. It's stealing trade secrets, stealing formulas, technological things, business details, and passing that information along to their own companies. The CIA has always insisted that they do not do that with U.S. companies. They don't steal, you know, French aerospace secrets and give that to American companies. They say that's just not their focus. They're in it for national intelligence, not for economic intelligence.
So who's doing it then? I mean, I can't believe that nobody's doing it.
Well, what you see is that companies do it themselves, and that's what I write about in the book, is that companies today are using all of the tools and the technologies and the, sometimes the same talent that the global intelligence agencies have been using since the Cold War. And so you see companies doing things like using satellite surveillance to monitor each other. You see companies mounting undercover operations to steal secrets from each other. I was in London last year, and I was meeting with some of the top British corporate espionage guys, and one of them was telling me about these laser microphones that they use, and this was fascinating to me. They can stand off, he said, about a kilometer from a target, put the invisible laser dot on the window of that target, and then record every conversation that happens in that room from a kilometer away without anyone seeing them. So there's a lot of espionage that's going on that's simply company-to-company spying, and that's a sort of a little-known piece of this folks haven't really focused on.
But surely, Eamon, this technology was developed by the spy agencies themselves, and the people that know how to operate them are probably a revolving door. So the idea that somehow the CIA is not involved in corporate espionage or economic intelligence seems a little a bit hard to swallow. I mean,
Well, if you're a skeptic, absolutely. I mean, I broke the story in Politico just this past week that the CIA actually has a program where it allows its own employees to moonlight in the private sector, to pick up extra work on nights and on the weekends. And in one case that I know of in the past, they worked for a firm called BIA, Business Intelligence Advisors, out of Boston. And at that firm, what they do is specialize in CIA-style lie detection technology and techniques, And what they're doing is they're listening in on corporate earnings calls, trying to see if there's any indication based on their psychological profiling that the CEOs of these companies are lying when they are describing the company's profits and its growth potential and all that. And then they're tipping off hedge fund clients as to whether or not this company looks like a good bet in its stock price for the coming quarter. So you see a case where in the past CIA people have gone and worked, you know, weekends and nights at a hedge fund consulting firm. So the contacts between U.S. intelligence and the U.S. financial industry are much closer than we might have thought.
And Eamon Javis, I recall when Ronald Reagan nominated Bill Casey as the director of Central Intelligence, Casey didn't want to put his holdings, his Wall Street portfolio, because he was a Wall Street banker, he didn't want to put them in a blind trust, and there was a bit of a flap over that. And in essence, people were asking the question that, well, if you're the head of the CIA, you have extraordinary assets in terms of being able to predict the futures market, being able to intercept the possibilities of important high-level information between corporate executives, etc.
There's this great sort of mutual fascination between the intelligence world and the finance world. They're both, each is intrigued by the other one, and there's a lot of cross-pollination. If you remember, just a couple of years ago, there was a fascinating story about the folks at DARPA, which is the sort of high-tech development agency inside the Pentagon, had been working on something to create a futures exchange where they would have the ability to predict future events based on stock sales. It was sort of a very, you know, over-the-top concept, but they were able to pull this thing together, and only when it erupted in controversy that they had been doing it were they able to shut it down.
Again, I'm speaking with Eamon Javis, the author of a new book just out, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, a book we're offering up for $125 donation to Background Briefing here at 818-985-5735. And one of the sort of amusing stories in your book is this war that went on between the giant company Nestle and Mars here in the United States, which is a privately held corporation, right? The Mars family still control this, and I believe the Mars family have put a lot of money into this so-called death tax issue in an effort to make sure that the super wealthy don't have to pay an inheritance tax.
That's right. I work and live here in Washington, not too far from the Northern Virginia headquarters of Mars, and in this area, Mars has just long been known as one of the most secretive companies in the area, and this is an area where we've got a lot of secrets. But the Mars folks have been very secretive for years, and I've always wondered why. And in writing this chapter, I sort of learned, you know, why they're so paranoid, and that's because the folks over at Nestle in the mid-1990s, through a series of cutouts, ran a fairly elaborate intelligence operation against them that involved a private spy firm that was staffed by former U.S. Secret Service members. And what they were doing was they were tailing these Mars executives when they went on corporate retreats. They were rifling through the trash at their hotel where they stayed in order to see if they'd left any intriguing documents. They booked the tables at the restaurant next to the Mars executives when they went out for dinner after the conference was over in order to overhear any details about the Mars plans. So all of this spying done by former U.S. Secret Service officers and others that worked for this private spy firm was all done, you know, to protect a new kind of candy that they were rolling out. I mean, I got a kick out of it because it was this incredible spying operation, and yet, you know, at stake was nothing more than a piece of candy.
And Eamon Javis, when the Cold War ended, of course, all of the GRU and the KGB guys were looking for employment. Now Putin, I think, has put them back in charge of the country. But that aside, some of them are out, even freelancing over here. I understand there's a group of former ex-Soviet spooks. They're set up at Tyson's Corner, aren't they, right there in Ground Zero?
Yeah, that's right. There's a spy firm here in the area called Trident Group, which is in Northern Virginia, and that firm is made up of ex-Soviet military intelligence and ex-KGB officers. And they're not too far away from the CIA, and they actually work for a lot of big American law firms now. Disney is a client of theirs, and they're offering intelligence services. And in their case, what they sell is intelligence on how to do business in Russia, who's who in the former Soviet Union. And it's a fascinating operation. These guys were sort of committed communists, you know, earlier in their youth, and they spent the early part of their career working to undermine the United States of America and the capitalist system, and now here they are making money and profiting from it, and they're entrepreneurs themselves. It's kind of a strange little codicil to the Cold War. And actually, I had coffee with the owner of that company over at Starbucks in Northern Virginia. It was a surreal experience to be sitting there with a ex-Soviet military intelligence officer having a coffee at Starbucks.
And some of the stuff that's been going on in London now between these exiled Russian billionaires is pretty nasty, not the least of which was radioactive tea, polonium, that killed one of them. So they play pretty rough, don't they?
Yeah, it can get a little hairy. I had somebody, a high-level former American diplomat, warned me away from this subject when I first started looking into it, saying to me, look, you know, people get killed over this kind of thing in Russia. And that's because, you know, there are billions of dollars at stake, and the global economy is sort of a wild and woolly place, and you've got all sorts of companies and individuals and powerful folks racing to get that all-important billionaire status, and as they're doing that, a lot of people are willing to cut a lot of corners. And it's not the old sort of clubby world of American business of a generation or two ago when everybody knew everybody and they'd all gone to the same colleges and people could take each other's measure this way. Now you've got American businesses dealing with Middle Eastern players, Russian oligarchs, all over Asia, new billionaires being minted daily. People don't know each other, and they're doing a lot of intelligence operations to figure out who the players are on the other side of each of these deals.
And in terms of international business, surely there's an awful lot of economic espionage that goes on. For example, it's possible that we could have another huge economic calamity like we did when Wall Street tanked over a year ago. There's a lot of disquiet now in Europe about the possibility of the Greeks defaulting, and then rippling through to Portugal and then some of these East Bloc countries that are highly borrowed heavily in euros, even though they're not in the eurozone. And in case of the Greek situation, which is unfolding as we speak, apparently what happened there was the consortium of German and French banks got together to try and rescue Greece, and the Greeks had never really given everybody an honest accounting of their books. So they floated these big international bonds on the bond market, offering 3% interest, which attracted a lot of people. And then suddenly, whatever 6 or 7 billion was for their target, they were way oversubscribed, so they were about to offer another offering when they got some intelligence that the same Greek officials they were dealing with had gone to the Chinese secretly and offered them a similar bond, and then the German and the French banks got so mad they pulled out, and that's caused this run on Greece. So it seems to me that would indicate the critical role of intelligence here, particularly
the stakes there couldn't be higher. I mean, you've got the entire global economy hanging on a thread of Greek debt default. And, that sort of goes to a point that I made in a piece for Politico.com last year, that the amount of interest by U.S. intelligence officials in the global economy and this huge meltdown that we saw in 2008, I reported that a year ago, the Pentagon held its first ever entire war game, one of these wargaming facilities that they normally use to sort of simulate tank warfare. They did an entire financial war game, and they actually brought down consultants and Wall Street traders, and they simulated a foreign attack on the U.S. dollar. If somebody wanted to cause the U.S. dollar to collapse in the global market, what kind of financial tools could they use to make that happen? And I think they were pretty horrified by what they found when they actually ran the simulation. in which these traders actually executed some strategies they thought could undermine the dollar pretty quickly. And you realize the economic vulnerability of the United States in this post-crash world, we're just not as strong as we were. And our intelligence agencies are doing everything they can to figure out exactly what the new vulnerabilities are and where our new weaknesses are. And I think they're a little bit unsettled by what they're finding.
Well, it's hardly new, but I think it was during the Nixon administration that the Soviets, through the KGB, tried to break the dollar and dump gold, they failed. So it would indicate to me that this idea that the CIA doesn't get involved in economic espionage is absurd. I mean, it's their they have to know what's happening in macroeconomic terms.
They absolutely pay attention. And they're absolutely trying to suss out who's who and where the weaknesses are. But what they insist they're not doing is they insist that they are not gaining sort of valuable secrets and then passing those along to American businesses. They say it's a one-way street that goes the other way. Intelligence goes from American businesses to the CIA, not vice versa.
And what about if the possibility of being able to finance yourself? I know that their money comes through black budgets, but for example, the Israeli services, the Mossad, they don't make much distinction between these commercial cutouts and these proprietary fronts that they put up and the activities of the billionaire, the guys involved. There was Mike Harari, who was down there in Panama, was Noriega's right-hand guy. And then we had this big movie producer here in Los Angeles, Arnon Milchan, was also involved with economic espionage, buying technology for nuclear weapons, etc. So it seems like the Israelis are much more comfortable with that. And I imagine the CIA being a bureaucracy, it's pretty hard to imagine that they could do it well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you talk to American CIA operatives and retired American CIA operatives, as I did a lot in the research for my book. You know, what they'll tell you is that working in the CIA in many ways is just like working in any other U.S. government bureaucracy. It's not nearly as glamorous as all that, and it's sort of an enormous government agency that functions the way other enormous government agencies do, and they sort of tack based on whatever the administration is that's in power at that time. They sort of do that administration's bidding, and they follow that administration's priorities, and they try to suck up to the new team in the White House just as the way that they do over at the Department of Labor and everywhere else in the U.S. government. So they portray it as, you know, a lot more sort of rudimentary and more bumbling maybe than we sort of think of the CIA through the Hollywood perception. But look, these people are working very, very hard. They're working round the clock, nights and weekends, holidays and everything else, trying to stay one step ahead of that next attack, whether it's economic or a terrorist attack or otherwise. So they have just an enormous, enormous amount of work to do, and so you gotta have some sympathy for them in terms of what they're trying to do. It's an enormous task.
Well, just in closing, Ayman Jarvis, again, the author of Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage. The book's full of all kinds of as I was saying, I was amused by some of the wars between Nestle and Mars. And is it at the moment, Cadbury and Nestle are in a battle, aren't they?
Yeah, and what I've been told by, you know, I was in London talking to some of these corporate surveillance operatives. These are the guys who tail big executives and corporate board of directors, and they follow them physically to see where they are, that in pretty much any deal, you know, any transaction, one company being sold to another that's worth more than about $1 billion anywhere in the world, one side or the other is using surveillance at this point. According to the guys who are hired to do the surveillance, that's what they told me, that they'll want to keep the board of directors under wraps. They'll want to keep the key lawyers in the deal and the transaction under wraps. They'll send, you know, veteran intelligence operatives to tail them and to find out where they're going and who they're meeting with. And they gave me some great stories of how they actually do that surveillance and how they play these sort of cat and mouse games where one side is following the other side, and then the first guys are trying to lose the second guys in order to be able to have a meeting that's actually secret. And it's very hard to keep secrets at that level.
Right. Well, that's what they call dry cleaning in the trade. And
That's right.
Just in closing, though, Eamon, we got a lot of. We're right here. Our studio is right across the street from Universal Studios here in North Hollywood, and I guarantee you, there's a lot of screenwriters listening in right now in this town, thinking, "Wow, I need to get hold of this book."
Yeah, well, I hope they do. I mean, I learned a lot about how the global economy really works and sort of the secret underbelly of this this industry. And what you don't know is that these companies are actually using the same tools and technologies and talent as the major global spy services are.
Well, we also
fascinated me.
We saw a bit of that in that really wonderful movie, Michael Clayton, where the antagonist, the corporate woman, hired these shadowy people to kill this errant guy. That
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know where they've reached that point yet, but it seems to be a slippery slope.
I didn't find any actual assassination.
Right. Well, but as I say, it's a slippery slope.
Right.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Eamon Jarvis.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'd love to talk about the book. It's a fun topic.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I just speak with Eamon Jarvis, who's covered Washington, the White House, and the intersection of government and Wall Street for a number of journals, including Politico and Business Week. As Washington's correspondent for Business Week magazine, he wrote extensively about the Jack Abramoff scandal, and he unearthed the fact that Abramoff had made under-the-table payments to political columnists in exchange for favorable coverage of his clients, investigative work for which he was given the Medill School of Journalism Award for distinction. His new book, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy, The Secret World of Corporate Espionage, is just out, and we're offering it up here for a $125 donation to Background Briefing here at KPFK Los Angeles. And I do hope you can pick up the phone now and make that call to 818-985-5735, because we really are way behind. I know it's a terrible time to be raising funds after people have been so generous to in support of the tragedy down in Haiti. We're also competing with KCRW and KUSC, and it's a tough environment. The minimum, of course, to donate to this station is $25, which I think is reasonably affordable, and we also welcome our generous supporters as well. 818-985-5735.
Right. We need about 50 people to call right now. Right now, you, one at a time. Our phone room is full right now of people ready to answer phones. There are three people calling. There's 47 more people to call. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. We only have, obviously, a couple minutes left to the top of the hour. $125. Broker, trader, lawyer, spy, the secret world of corporate espionage. 818-985-5735. Authoritarianism in American politics, that's a $125 pledge of support, and the shadow elite as well, $125. Again, this is the book we're featuring right now, Broker, Trader, Lawyer, Spy by Eamon Jarvis. We just heard Ian's interview with him. Bill Moyers says about this book, if only the mainstream press, now I'm breaking in here, remember, we're not the mainstream press, but if only the mainstream press would follow Eamon Jarvis' lead and expose the powerful saboteurs and predators of the corporate underworld, this would be a different country. But it's not too late. Read this book and roll up your sleeves, and it's not too late to support KPFK by picking this up for a $125 pledge of support. There's another call. We need 44 more people to call right now. Ian Masters, 818-985-5735. Now, for $365, a dollar a day, you can get all three books we offer this hour, and we'll throw in on top of that 8 hours of audio of Howard Zinn from the Pacifica Radio Archives. And among those 8 hours includes the interview with Noam Chomsky that was on KPFK this morning about Howard Zinn and his legacy. So that's $365. And that is, so right now we have 42 more calls we need right now, 818-985-5735. For $365, you get all three books featured today, plus the MP3 CD, 8 hours of Howard Zinn from the Pacifica Radio Archives, going all the way back to 1963 and all the way up until this morning when